Thank you for reconvening. And it's wonderful how quiet you become so quickly, so thank you. Our first session for this morning after the public comment session is on performance, potential performance standards. And our first speaker is Dr. John Lauterbach from Lauterbach & Associates, speaking on keeping it simple, keeping it cheap and simple, while others call for costly complexity. Dr. Lauterbach.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the FDA for holding this workshop and accepting my abstract for presentation. I'd just like to touch base on a couple of things that from yesterday's meeting. I'm particularly dealing with first formaldehyde. The alpha chemists in the group report the results of their assays as formaldehyde. What we don't know for sure, particularly in a high glycol, high water environment, is that formaldehyde is there as formaldehyde gas or as other hydrated species, such as methylene glycol or other oligomers of formaldehyde combined with water. So just please remember that. Also, please remember there's a great wealth of data under all sorts of smoking conditions out there in the literature on formaldehyde deliveries and other carbonyl deliveries from conventional cigarettes under all sorts of smoking conditions. The second follow-up from yesterday is that there was questions on mixture toxicology. There is a tremendous amount of inhalation toxicology and supporting chemistry and in vitro toxicology on flavors and flavor mixtures in the literature. It's very easy to find. Third, Lauterbach & Associates, that's my company. We're paying our own way here. Our business basically is we help small tobacco product manufacturers who are now into also getting into the e-cigarette business meet FDA regulations. We've been in business now for 10 years, and I have three associate scientists that help me from time to time. Okay, what we're heading for in this presentation today is to take a look at some very recent toxicology studies on the cigarette-like e-cigarettes, not the tanks, not the bazookas, but basically things that I buy at my local convenience store. We always talk about alcohol technology. That's some of my original background. I want to show some things that basically can help out on this area, but they're not total solutions. I want to discuss some of the things dealing with hazards versus test complexity, particularly covering on whether the test is going to tell us anything, and like so many other tests that we've had in the cigarette industry, do they really tell us anything that we don't know already? And finally, he's outlined an approach which basically is minimal testing and resulting in minimal hazard by more of a consensus standard approach. Now, just for everybody's clarification here, there's four recent studies in the peer-reviewed literature. The first one by Steve Hecht on basically urinary biomarkers of smokers, and most of these smokers were basically tank systems. He did have others with the cartomizers and the disposables. Basically, again, very low levels of biomarkers associated with metabolites of pHs, Crolin, whatever, TSNAs versus conventional tobacco products. And then we have the three papers from Lorillard, some of that you saw yesterday afternoon in Bob Lever's presentation on in vitro toxicology, another paper on basically e-cigarette aerosol chemistry, and the third one dealing with exposure to bystanders. So all these are, I believe, open access literature, including the one in regulatory toxicology and pharmacology. That's a very interesting paper if you're ever concerned about deliveries on the cigar-like products. Okay? But basically, taken together says that we have a class of products that is very low in hazard compared to conventional cigarettes. These, again, are talking about commercial products, some of those you saw pictures of in the presentation yesterday afternoon. And I think the bottom line here is, at least for one class of e-cigarettes, we have a product with such reduced hazard that we need a different regulatory approach. Again, as we go through our thoughts on testing, we have to have meaningful testing, must be affordable, and must produce timely results. If the test takes 3 months to complete, that's not going to be very helpful. Unless we're talking about some basic research such as inhalation studies. I mean, it must be, we're going to measure something here, the dose mix, the poison, as mentioned earlier. We know that many laboratories can find very trace amounts of things in tobacco products and other consumer products, in air, whatever. I get every year or so something from the Macon Water Authority, we live in Macon, Georgia, telling me all the trace contaminants in the drinking water, but it still passes the U.S. EPA requirements. So, but nobody seems to get concerned over trace amounts of things, but they're there, because most of these results are below levels of toxicological concern, whether it's in vegetables, which have a whole host of heavy metals in them, where they're, the soil they're grown in, water runoff, everything else out there has some levels of contamination, but they're all generally below the levels of toxicological concern. So the question comes in, can we really look at the same thing in terms of e-liquids and e-cigarette aerosols? Now, we talked a little bit about testing. A lot of people would like to put a tremendous amount of testing into this product, okay? And I realize if I were on the other side of the fence with a great laboratory to run, I'd want to test everything, too. It's job security. Just an example here of a software that helps people get through some of the analyses. But again, it helps give them, on some of these mass spec identifications. I'm trying to get a mouse here, and I went backwards. But this gives you some better information about some of the mass spec identifications. Obviously, nothing substitutes for great chromatography and a whole bunch of standards. Now, another project we've been working on with Dr. Andre Spencer over in Wilson, North Carolina, is looking at sources of carbonyls from PG and glycerin, particularly formaldehyde, acetaldehyde, and acrolein. We've been using C13 labeled product. And that allows us to say what's coming from the glycerol or PG versus what may be coming from other points in the device, such as outgassing of polymeric materials, et cetera. And just a brief outline of what we've done. We started this work earlier in the year. We basically have gone to a more refined thing with larger amounts of label used in the cartomizer. At 10 drops, you could always say, well, maybe we're pyrolyzing things. Again, we've working somewhat 55-33 profile, 55-230. Again, puffed until there's no visible aerosol. Again, using the standard carbonyl procedure. Again, please remember that anything that could be a hydrated carbonyl and stay hydrated under actual human use is going to show up as formaldehyde. This gives, again, a summary of some of our results. I call your attention to this last point. Yeah, we did find a high level of formaldehyde, about a microgram per puff, but this was an anhydrous system. If you notice, a lot of the e-liquids have water in them, and we don't have the results to report today. But adding water to the e-liquid reduces its tendency to form carbonyl compounds. So, where are we? We can test a number of things. We have to ask our question, will a very extensive testing regime improve overall public health? Will it improve the health of the e-cigarette users or their bystanders? Will it allow a clear distinction between what's good and what's bad? Is it going to be practical to administer? How many toxicologists do we have out there to review data from every single vape shop that's doing formulations? Okay. We have enough problems just dealing with conventional tobacco products in data review, let alone everything else out there. So I'm going to say that the question is, based on what we know about the toxicology of the flavors that are out there, and this stuff is in the literature, folks, inhalation experiments, toxicology is out there for glycerol, for PG, for these flavors. It's in the literature. Okay? Go read it. I'm going to come here and I say, based on what's out there in the literature, and what I know, what I've seen over my career, is likely a product space that includes products that have much lower hazards than especially conventional cigarettes and some of the larger e-cigarettes and have good consumer acceptance. In fact, we have this product space. Can we work by voluntary consensus standards dealing with a standard on product composition, a standard on product testing, and standard test methods? This is all consensus standards. You know, we already have an ISO tobacco committee working as a tag under ANSI. We have all these other organizations. I've certainly worked in the past with ASTM committees. Let's get these work together, product standards, performance standards, and test methods. Okay, so we get all the interested parties, producers, users, consumers, general interest, sit down under the auspices of one of these standards-generating organizations and come down to an approach which defines acceptable components for an e-liquid, compound and concentrations, and device standards, and test standards and test methods. That's one approach, voluntary consensus standards. Another approach is, you've got to remember here, we have a lot of over-the-counter pharmaceuticals. At least the thing is, you know, this includes this OTC monograph, even includes warning labels, like you look at some of the cold preparations, do not take with alcohol, do not take when you're taking other medications. Can we use the same approach that's used for cold tablets, certain bronchodilators, whatever, as a way of having in a simpler regulatory system for e-liquids and e-cigarettes? In other words, what's allowed, what's not allowed? This is an example here, okay, of things that I thought about, that, hey, what I'd allow with appropriate purity certificates or analysis, et cetera. There's certain things I would not allow in an e-liquid I found already in my work. I'd allow certain volatile flavors, lots of things of known composition, at the MULs, appropriate based on the toxicology. I would not allow non-volatile flavors that are going to pyrolyze on the nichrome wire. Mixtures of varying composition, thermally unstable mixtures, and obviously we have the strong allergens and the cytotoxic agents. So, what we're basically saying here is e-liquids in product space would not require extensive testing. Just make sure we're using the right grade of materials and have our certificates analysis and a way of verifying those certificates of analysis by occasional checking the analytical. So anyway, take-home messages. We have this class of products that we have done human biomarkering on them, the toxicology, the chemistry, that basically show a very low degree of hazard versus to both users and bystanders. Okay? Thus, we don't need the extensive testing if we basically can run this thing as we run an OTC monograph type thing for an over-the-counter pharmaceutical or by consensus standards. The extensive testing goes in for people that want to bring in novel products that are not part of the product space that we want to go for initially. Yes, someone wants to bring other things. Let's then they have to show that they are the truly no more hazardous than what we've already defined in product space. And also, finally here, is a lot of the hazardous, potentially hazardous constituent testing that's labeled for conventional tobacco products isn't appropriate for e-cigarettes. So it's basically, we have no carbon monoxide, no nitrogen oxides, no hydrogen cyanides, no aromatic means, etc. So thank you very much.
Okay, our next presenter, I know your program says that it has two speakers, but Dr. Colburn will be doing both, and he'll be speaking on voluntary standards, mandatory standards, and special controls, considerations for performance standard development. Dr. Colburn from CDR, Center for Devices and Radiologic Health. Sorry about that.
Good morning. And before I start, I guess I need to give a few disclosures because I'm not Carol Herman. She sends her apologies. She fell ill, and due to her work, she travels quite extensively, and I think she caught a bug somewhere along between China and Europe and New Orleans or somewhere else. So I sent her apologies, but I did agree to kind of present her slides to the group as an example of a standard developing organization. A second disclosure, I'm actually not a PhD. I'm a nurse, a master's prepared nurse. I do appreciate the accolade, and I just couldn't bear the thought of going to school that extra couple of years, I guess. So my apologies for that. Third, I will be presenting my talk from the focus of how the FDA, Center for Devices Radiological Health, utilize the voluntary consensus standards in its regulatory science and its approaches. I'm not here to be promoting or discussing or even suggesting how the Center for Tobacco Products should consider the use of these, but it is. I was asked to come and describe a methodology that some of the centers, and specifically Center for Devices, does utilize the voluntary consensus standards, and how that was given birth to from the overall National Transfer Technology Advancement Act and the OMB Circular A119, which kind of provides the guidelines to the agencies on how they could participate and utilize standards. And I think John touched on some of the, in his 12th slide, a little bit about, some of the desires and how consensus standards can be beneficial. So with that, I will try to go through a little bit on Carol's slides, and then I'll give a brief overview of how the Center for Devices program works in this space, and we have a very robust program, and AAMI is one of several organizations that we are a member of. So I will try to go through with this, and is that the right one to use? All right, got my buttons. They left it nice and easy. So I would say this little device here complies with HE75, which is a usability standard. It has three buttons on it. It's very simple for someone like myself who, I guess you thought I was a PhD, but because of these nice devices, I can look smart and make them work for you. So thank God. All right, so who is AAMI? AAMI is an accredited standard developing organization underneath the American National Standards Association or Institute, and they have more than 7,000 members. And just from a show of hands, other than I know my FDA person, who here has a membership to a standard developing organization? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So a lot of this is going to seem like alphabet soup to you. Just like your previous discussions in the area of Center for Tobacco was alphabet soup to me, where I didn't understand, you're going to get your share of alphabet soup here from a different area if you're not familiar with standards. But I hope at the end of this you might understand what a voluntary consensus standards organization is and how a federal agency such as FDA does have memberships into these organizations. As it shows up there, there's over 300 different corporate and institutional members. We are a sustaining member within this organization. We do sit on their board of directors. We are involved with their foundation, and we sit on virtually every one of their working groups. Same as with other organizations like CLSI, ASTM, a number of others. I think we're currently just in the Center for Devices on about 26 different standard developing organizations because we find very, very strong ties and for us to be able to get our work through them. As mentioned, they are an accredited association. ANSI is, if you kind of do an analogy to maybe hospital accreditations, ANSI is to AAMI as JACO is to a hospital. They do the accreditation. It's not mandatory that the organizations are accredited, but there is great worth in the accreditation process. It allows the federal government to have an understanding of how standards are developed through these organizations, going through the criteria and the essential requirements. So there is great value in understanding that it is an accredited organization. They administer several technical committees within the international space, such as ISO and IEC. They hold both a U.S. tag and secretariat to several of those, which we'll see examples from. So it is one of our organizations like AAMI and ASTM and others. Through the accreditation of ANSI allows us to get involved with the international standards, which of course from a globalization and marketing and making sure that the U.S. marketplace is strong is a very important tool for us. And as a federal agency, we want to do what we can to make sure the U.S. marketplace is strong through these types of organizations. Standards, obviously, and this is one of their main scopes, standards should only be developed only when there is a clear need, and that's very simple. So if I was speaking on behalf of Carol Herman, why would I want to build a standard for you that I'm not going to be able to sell and at least sustain the cost that it took to build that standard, right? So they definitely look at the scope when these new work item proposals come in, and they want to make sure that these standards are something that is a true need to whatever the scope for that standard that is driving for. One product, one standard, one test worldwide. A couple years ago, I gave a talk on something called Standards Wars, and that was because we do see times where there might be three or four different organizations working on standards in a similar space, and, you know, for all of us that are members to that, that just means we're working four times as hard with four times as much time, and we would like to have that done in one single place with all the right experts there. And so that's the goal of the standard developing organizations. And it is through the ability of members who can be involved in a number of different organizations to help oversee that type of activity. That button didn't work that time. different types of documents that AAMI does produce. They do basic performance and safety standards. Those can be recommendations on labeling, basic safety and performance criteria, primarily for the device manufacturers. We do utilize them in the Center for Devices, and we recognize them through the authority that we have in our act. And that does help us communicate both to our staff internally and educate, as well as to the industry members submitting documents in on how they went through and demonstrated some level of maybe safety and effectiveness, or they addressed a certain process through risk management and the number of different aspects that standards do address. AAMI also has what's called recommended practices. These are guidelines for use care evaluation, typically for the end user. So there may be the people that do the disinfection of products in the hospital. They write guidelines so people would understand how the design of a particular device, and maybe it's through its labeling on the recommendations that it goes through a reuse protocol, is utilized. So recommended practice is created for that. It's not a best practice. It's a recommended practice, a little bit different. We also have technical information reports, which kind of get a little bit more into the granularity from some of these massive standards, such as, like, say, sterilization, where you need a technical report to get a little bit more understanding. These are similar to the technical specification reports that you might find in an ISO or IEC standard. This is just a big kind of snapshot of some of the areas in ISO and IEC that AAMI is involved in. So they obviously, and I think if my numbers are remembered correct, about 70% of their work is actually through the ISO and IEC portal. So although they're a U.S. national standards developing organization, 70% of their work is to make sure they're involved in there. And that's because their stakeholders are by and large global marketers. You know, medical devices are typically the same here as they are in China, or as they are in Europe or anywhere else. And I'm referring to the user end of it, maybe not the manufacturing end. But the reason why the international standards are so important is that people want to be able to manufacture their stuff globally. So an international standard in this case is more appropriate for this type of manufacturing company. Who can participate in standards development? Any stakeholder who has an interest, essentially. We have an interest, we're a member, manufacturers, academia, users, consumer advocates, et cetera, and who writes standards? These are the technical committees, the subject matter experts that are part of these organizations. It's led through a leadership of co-chairs, one producer and one general interest or user representative, generally in the AAMI model, which helps balance out some of the issues. The goal and overarching endpoint is to make sure whatever that standard represents didn't get overshadowed by a majority that didn't represent balance of what needs to come into the standard developing process. Quick flow charts. Again, we're going to start getting into charts and alphabet soup here. You go through a proposal into the drafting stages, balloting, you get the public review, even if you're not a member. As an accreditation, one of the processes through ANSI, all standards go out through something called Standards Action, so the general public has the opportunity to submit comments, and that is a very common thing to see, especially when we're addressing safety issues, where the public is well aware of a safety issue going on in the field. And so we do receive comments, and it is the responsibility of the organization to make sure that those comments are heard by the committee, and that the person who did submit those comments understands that how those comments were received and if they were accepted or not. Goes through approval process and then to publication. And then at that point, it is there for the stakeholders. The agency can look at those standards and decide how they would want to utilize them, and I'll describe those later. So it goes through all the different stages, and I'm not going to hit on all these, but I kind of just discussed them earlier. But one of the things I want to impress upon, and you'll see this slide twice, so I'm going to say Carol stole this slide, but you'll see it a little bit larger later. But what it really exemplifies is that being involved early is the most important way to ensure that if you have something to say, that it gets heard and that it has a chance to be incorporated in a more granular and more technical sense. If you come in towards the latter stages of the development of a standard, it's very hard to wiggle that in because the standard has already been set from a technical aspect. So it's very important to be involved and not go in at the end and say, I don't like it. Well, you know, you're going to have to wait for the next cycle. So the impression is, you know, try to be involved at an early stage. You're seen as a valuable expert. We want to hear that expertise at the most earliest stage possible. Committee, there's a balloting stage, obviously, that goes through. Each organization has a formal test of consensus, you know, through this ANSI accreditation process. And as I mentioned earlier, there is a formal process required to ensure the openness and due process through that open public review. And that's real important. And I'll describe a little bit later on how our center's approach to utilizing standards and our authorities and how that kind of matches a little bit about our good guidance practices and how we develop guidance and the requirements that we see in the similarities of getting public comment before going out to something final, very similar into the approach of how a standard is developed, which is why we have really found the value of being involved in that, because we do get to hear from the stakeholders who would otherwise comment into a guidance, and we're finding that we can get more into standards sometimes, and I'm seeing smiles from some of our technical experts in the room. Individuals cannot comment directly on ISO or IC documents, but must work through their national member body or national committee. And that's real important to understand that as a member to any ISO committee, you're not there on your own behalf, but you're there on part of the U.S. delegation. So I myself, you know, I sit on several international committees, but I'm not there representing FDA. I'm representing the U.S. delegation, and so the U.S. is the body that we work through. Those are held through and managed through ANSI, and so you need to make sure you're submitting your comments to the appropriate person when working into an international standard. And John did mention that there is an ISO committee that deals with tobacco products, and so if you wanted to comment onto those, you'd have to make sure you understand who the appropriate organization here is in the U.S. that holds that U.S. tag. I'm going to go through. Obviously, because there's a process and a due process and a balance, there's even an ability to appeal a final approval. We have found in certain standards that maybe even through the whole stage of commenting and balloting, and you know, it makes it through and gets published, and we find out, oh geez, look at that standard really still has a potential to even create a public health risk if it was going to be adopted, referenced, or just utilized in any manner which a standard could be. There is a formal process where you can request for an appeal of a standard, and that's to ensure those types of issues do take place. Standards are developed by experts. Experts are humans. Humans err. So we do realize you need to have a built-in check kind of for those types of processes as well. Which organization is the best author for a document? That's always an interesting slide. But it really, you know, each organization, AMI is one example, where they have a specific scope and a specific concentration on areas. A lot of those areas overarch some of the discussions that we had today. There is committees on biocompatibility. There's committees on battery safety, risk management, quality systems, things like that. But it is focused at medical devices. An area for e-cigarettes would have to consider if they wanted to develop standards, if there wasn't already an existing committee, what would be the appropriate organization for such standards to take place? Or are there current existing standards so we don't have to reinvent the wheel that we could utilize and adopt for this process? And I'm just going to continue to go through here so I can get through our comments. Let's see. All right, so this is just a quick analogy showing the stages that you would see in a standard developing process. So AMI has, you know, Newark Guidance Proposals, IC has a new proposal, and Newark Guidance Proposal is similar in ISO, and it goes through the different stages to the final drafts, and from there the publication of a document is made. You'll see that it is very similar, and if you heard what I mentioned earlier, the medical device industry is largely a global industry, and so their standards are largely in that global platform. You see one organization here that is focused in that medical device arena really try to match itself to ensure that it's doing the best for its stakeholders and its members. So with that, I will continue on into my presentation, and then later I think we'll have time for a little panel and be happy to take any questions that we have. Okay, let's see. Oh, do you guys do the next slide or do I just keep going? Oh. Fast for you. All right. So a bunch more slides, a bunch more alphabet soup from a Center for Devices perspective here. So as mentioned, I am the director of the CDRH's standards program, the Center for Devices and Radiological Health. And later you'll actually hear from one of our experts. I don't propose my last disclaimer is I'm not an expert in anything. That's why they made me the director of the program. I have about 375 experts that operate in the over 600 different working groups that the Center for Devices and Radiological Health operates within. And that's because we have products and devices of all different types, shapes, sizes, processes, needing different performance requirements, and it's just a huge myriad of areas that we need to be involved in. So by golly, they wouldn't have me be involved in. They just say, you know, you're the director and let everyone else do the hard work for you. All right, so I'm going to kind of give you a perspective of, you know, where did this all start? Why is the FDA so involved? I mentioned 375 people, 600 different working groups in a little teeny center of devices and radiological health that has about, you know, which is one of the smaller centers here actually in the agency. And by God, it actually represents over 10% of the government's involvement in standards. And that's because of the types of products and the wide variance of them. But there is a precipitous factor of where this all drives from. And so I'm going to go through and you'll see some of this up there, but NIST is the National Institute of Standards and Technology underneath the Department of Commerce, and they've been assigned the responsibility to coordinate the federal, state, and local technical standards and conformity assessment activities, as well as coordinate those in the private sector. And they help manage the commerce standards through a committee called the Interagency Committee on Standards and Policy, which I actually am a member to. And so are a number of different organizations like the FCC, OSHA and Department of Labor, the CPSC, EPA, and this is a group of government members that work together to try to make sure they understand what the roles and responsibilities of their departments or agencies are to make sure we're meeting the needs of what the direction NIST has, because they have an act that directs them to help federal agencies to adopt private sector standards in lieu of creating government-unique, non-consensus standards. It also tells them to encourage participation in these standards bodies. One of such that we've seen is AAMI, as we saw before. We've also made mention to ASTM and a number of others. It does direct NIST to coordinate the federal, state, and local governments to have greater reliance on using voluntary standards and decrease dependency on in-house standards. And truly, the reason why that is it's a cost factor. It is very, very laborious and costly to develop your own government-unique standard. The government realizes that. Stakeholders realize that, so this is a way for us to help understand what's another tool that we can use to help meet our needs, and is that tool more effective? The OMB circular is another document that came out to help set forth the requirements for making sure the agency understands that, yes, it is okay for you to sit at the table and discuss your needs as a stakeholder in this process. But we do want to hear, the Office of the White House does want to hear what your involvement is. How are you utilizing voluntary consensus standards? Where are your needs where you're developing government unique standards? Because it's not prohibited, obviously, to write a government unique standard, but they do want to collect that type of information so they understand where are government unique standards still needed and why. And is there a way that we can help develop other processes to help reduce costs to the government by developing different processes to where standards or other processes would exist? And that's part of the tool of what this circular does. It also discusses the incorporation by reference and where standards come in. And as I see my yellow light coming on, I'm going to get moving. As I discussed, it eliminates unnecessary costs. It promotes the economic competition by getting the stakeholders involved when you're at the table. And we find great value in hearing from our stakeholders. In fact, just yesterday we had a phenomenal meeting downtown with Standard Developing Organization. We got a lot of great feedback and support because we were able to be there and discuss the regulatory science needs in a very technical standard dealing with biological gas pathways of breathing circuits. I mean, that's a very technical standard. I'm not even going to begin to tell you what it's about. But because we were able to be there, all the other stakeholders felt that it was a very useful tool for them. We do have our own guidelines that tell us how to participate and why, you know, why that we want the encouragement on participation, give some direction to the experts about how we should be doing this. None of it's a secret. We have our own policy. We have our own staff manual guide that sets policies for each center and the development on the use of standards and common definitions. And I do have on the website there where you can find those things. For our own program, we have our own authorities written into the Medical Device Amendments Act, and it was brought out where that's where we started writing our own government unique standards. It was very difficult, and obviously, to keep up with all the different technology, so we had the Modernization Act, which brought in and asked us to formally recognize all or impart a standard through a declaration of conformity. And this allows us to, you know, to communicate to the public those voluntary consensus standards, which we feel are very valuable to us, and we would encourage the industry stakeholders to communicate to us on how they did utilize that. And we find that it's a very good dialogue and understanding of how they went through the technical aspects. So I'm still okay. Oh, you make me sweat, and then you give me green. Is what I'm saying good, maybe, or okay. So real quick, I'm not going to read this word for word for you, but this is, in fact, what's written into our Food and Drug, the Modernization Act, but it just says, you know, the agency by publication of the Federal Register can recognize all or part of a standard where a person may submit a declaration of conformity. And if they elect to use that standard, they would provide that declaration of conformity to the agency that certifies that the device is in conformance with such standard. It says that they are in conformance, not that they will be, not that they'll think about it, but they are in conformance. And there are penalties to lying to the government when you do go through that formal declaration process. We also have the authority written into this to withdraw such a standard. I did mention where standards maybe are, you know, we thought they were great, we recognize them, and then maybe we learn through the stakeholders or through an appeals process that standard maybe didn't quite hit the mark where we really wanted. And so we do have the authority to withdraw a standard. Or maybe a standard's been updated. The new and improved version, newer technology keeps moving along in our field, so we can recognize a newer standard as well. And that communication tool that we do through the Federal Register notice, and then we have a website that has a database that shows all the standards that we recognize, is a really great tool both to educate our own staff, but as well as the stakeholders who need to come through our regulatory processes to understand what is the agency's view on if you would choose to use this voluntary consensus standard approach. This kind of just goes into a little bit about a little bit further about if we accept the declaration conformity. Some standards, and not very many, but some standards do have a complete quantitative approach to them. They have endpoints built into them. The test methods are very specific. And in a company may be able to just say, we declare conformance to that standard, and the agency might say, thank you. But many standards, and I would say 70 to 80% of them, aren't that specific. They do have ranges or maybe a minimum, but they don't have everything. And so we may still need a summary test report in support of a declaration where someone would choose to use that standard. And if we agree to all the endpoints and how they justified why those endpoints did mitigate any risk through a risk assessment and the channel of other standards, then we would again say thank you, or we might ask for some additional information. One thing I always tell people is that, and this helps relax both the agency personnel that get in, you know, a little squirmish when we say, you know, we're going to recognize the standard, but also is an informative tool to the end users, that conformance is not your clearance to the market. Conformance doesn't give you approval. The way to get to the market is a big puzzle, right? And there's a lot of pieces, and standards might give you a few of those pieces to help give you that picture. The more standards that are utilized and communicated between the FDA and Center for Devices and Radiological Health and its stakeholders, more of that picture gets filled in, and it does help us get devices to market. It helps us track how those standards are effective tools for that. But it is always important to make sure that they don't feel that I use that standard, therefore I get to go to market. That's not the case. There's always much more to getting somewhere. There's an important tool to always remember, that falsifying anything in your application is against the law. And so we do have that authority in here that describes that any device for which a declaration of conformity has been falsified is adulterated. So if you're going to conform, you need to conform, and you must conform. If an inspector found out you didn't, you are now adulterated. So real quick, just to finish off here, then, the center here uses, and the agency by and large, uses regulations and product standards as the yardsticks that define the specific requirements manufacturers can follow to assure product safety and provide accurate information to health professionals, consumers, all in one breath. But they are important because they do build consistency, credibility. They hit all these different areas from performance characteristics down to labeling and risk assessments. They give greater potential to save time and money for the agency. They open participation by all affected parties. They minimize and limit inconsistent standards internationally and can lead to national or international harmonization if that product would require such, in fact, and I think several others. So it's obviously something that needs to be considered in this space as well, which is why we already have one committee in ISO. Standards often do represent leading-edge thinking on an issue. It may not be the tip of the spear, but what it does is it gets the majority up to a level where safety can be addressed, and then we have a better understanding of how to take that next step moving forward to address the safety concern if we understand where the bar is set through other standards that are developed. Slides on time here just really talks about the government's participation standard, and so maybe this is my message to my other colleagues in the government why it is important to consider being a participant in the standards development process. And it's not that you are the technical expert, but the government is usually the only one who sits at the table that truly understands their regulatory responsibilities, their regulatory laws, and it is very helpful for the other stakeholders to have that understanding as part of the balance, and that makes the standard a much more effective tool. And that's one of the messages that I always stand and give when we talk about government's participation, and that's is why it's so important. Here's that slide again, obviously important. The earlier that we're involved, the more effective our tool of bringing regulatory science into a standard is there, and it is a very important thing for us when we are able to be there. So bottom line, participation is key. To influence the outcomes, you need to be involved. You need to be there. These are wonderful venues to do these types of activities, to figure out what are our next steps, what can we do to collaborate. So I do appreciate and want to thank the Center for Tobacco Products to invite us to have this discussion, and all the stakeholders that presented earlier. I think your comments really hit a lot of areas that standards probably will be listening to and waiting for your new work item proposals in the future. So with that, I leave you with an example of a about 100 or so different standards that
I did exercise moderator's prerogative since he had to give somebody else's slides, and if you all have done that, he got an extra few minutes. So thank you very much. Okay, our next speaker, Sud Patwardhan from Nickel Ventures, British American Tobacco Group, will be speaking on I screwed up. I got so excited by my moderator's prerogative. I'm sorry. Ken Skodak is going to be speaking on standards considerations for battery-powered devices, and he is from the FDA Center for Devices and Radiologic Health. Ken, I'm very sorry. You're up next.
Forward and backward, okay? And if you want to use the pointer, see how it's not showing up, but he'll get it up before you if
okay,
you want
great,
it.
Great, thank you.
Good morning. So I'm here today to present to you the standards considerations for battery-powered devices. I'm actually the co-leader of the Center's Battery-Powered Medical Devices Working Group. I work in the Office of Device Evaluation as a policy analyst and have been with FDA for 6 years before coming from the medical device industry. As disclosures, I'm an FDA employee and have no relationship or financial interest to disclose. So you're probably thinking, why does FDA care about batteries and battery-powered devices? So it's all about safety and performance. You're going to see that throughout my presentations today. So FDA does not regulate batteries, but FDA does regulate medical devices, and batteries are one of the critical components in those devices. Failure of their battery can result in catastrophic consequences and failures of the medical device. As an electrical engineer, I know that a power source as a battery can be simplified and presented using this annotation here. A battery seems like such a simple thing. In fact, it's a very complex component. The available voltage and current vary depending on the design, or the manufacturing, characteristics, the load, the temperature, the storage time, and for rechargeable batteries, the number and depth of discharge and recharge cycles. Batteries are anything but simple. Earlier today and throughout this workshop, I've seen a lot of presentations about how the devices are performing. I'm wondering if they're using a standard battery, if they're using a power supply, how they're regulating and making sure that that battery has the same operating characteristics through all the testing, because independent of all the other characteristics of the e-liquids and the components themselves, the battery itself can affect the performance of that product. The table here summarizes some of the common problems with batteries independent of the medical device. As you can see here, these problems can be very serious, including overheating, fires, and explosions. And I'm sure you can all agree that no one wants any of those in e-cigarettes. So what could possibly go wrong with a battery-powered medical device? So now let's look at some of the beyond the battery itself and look at some of the examples of problems with medical devices caused by battery-related issues. So this is an automated external defibrillator, or AED. This is a recent story here from the local news in the Washington, D.C. metro area. A passenger died after suffering a sudden cardiac arrest when the AED could not be used because the battery was depleted. In fact, an analysis of the FDA's database identified that approximately 5% of all reports and adverse events during a 3.5-year period were related to battery. That's 75,000 events. In fact, battery-related issues are one of the leading causes of device malfunctions of a variety of critical devices, such as external defibrillators, infusion pumps, and ventilators. Now, you're probably thinking that batteries are important, especially in a life-saving device like an AED, but what could possibly go wrong with lower-risk devices? So here I present to you an electronic thermometer. How many have used an electronic thermometer before or have children? So I'm a recent new parent, and I have a 4-month-old son at home. I left him this morning. And I can imagine all the challenges that I'm going to have in the years ahead, but one of the things that I know is that my son luckily has not been sick yet. But I do recall when the physician told me that their temperature has to get above a certain level, if it's below a certain level, if it's okay. If it's above a certain level, you should immediately rush to the hospital. So you can imagine that we bought a very high-quality electronic thermometer. Now, I want you to imagine that that electronic thermometer actually isn't so accurate as the battery voltage decreases. In some cases, we found that the electronic thermometers don't present the accurate temperature as the battery is nearly depleted, and it might not be presented to the end user. Another example of a medical device, electronic toothbrush or an electric toothbrush. So you probably use your electric toothbrush 2 to 3 times a day, and you're probably thinking, what could possibly go wrong with my electric toothbrush? What, it shuts off early or it doesn't work? Well, you can imagine brushing your teeth in the morning, and all of a sudden, bang, you hear an explosion, your ears are ringing, and you're trying to figure out what's going on. This, in fact, happened. In some cases, electronic toothbrushes were exploding as a result of the gases that were being emitted from the battery, which were sealed inside the plastic case. So that plastic case is sealed to prevent water getting in, but in some cases, that mechanism prevents the explosive gases from getting out. Another example for you, so a sinus irrigation system. So say you have a sinus infection or you had some sinus surgery and you're trying to prevent an infection. And you basically use this to wash saline through your sinus passages. Now, have you ever opened a remote that hasn't been used for a while, say for your TV, and you open it up, it's not working, and what do you see in there? You see the batteries are corroded. Now, can you imagine if the design of the device was such that the battery corrosion and those materials leaked into the saline, and then you were rinsing those materials through your sinus cavities? No one wants that. So in order to proactively address these and many other issues, the FDA formed what's called the Battery Working Group. Our mission and objectives are provided here on this slide. The group includes staff from various parts of the organization, the Office of Device Evaluation, Office of Science and Engineering Labs, Office of Surveillance and Biometrics, and Office of Communication and Education. Last summer, we hosted a 2-day workshop, much like today's workshop. The goals of the workshop are listed here. We had nearly 700 individuals registered for the workshop, including representatives from the medical device manufacturers, battery manufacturers, battery testing firms, healthcare providers, patients, as well as U.S. and international regulators. In the pre-meeting survey, nearly 1/3 of those registered for the workshop identified their goal is to learn FDA's expectations and requirements for regulation of batteries. However, we brought everyone together to learn as much as we could about what to do in the future. FDA currently recognizes 3 standards for batteries, UL 1642 for lithium batteries, which are commonly used in many consumer products, UL 2054 for household and commercial batteries, and IE 62133, which is focused on the safety requirements for secondary batteries. So to put this, these standards in context, standards can be highly technical documents that are negotiated and agreed upon by tenured technical experts. However, I'd like you to understand some of the content of the document. Here you can see that it's important that the battery doesn't explode or catch fire. So is the issue with the battery or the battery-powered device? The answer is both. In order to emphasize this point, I'd like to share a quote from one of my colleagues, Hamad Gatz. If it is impossible to assure that the battery failure cannot be prevented, the system can often be designed such that the failure cannot harm the patient. So here are two examples of standards that are referenced quite frequently for electronic medical devices. The first standard applies to basic safety and essential performance, and the second standard applies to electromagnetic compatibility or interference. So you can picture someone using an electronic cigarette while they're holding their smartphone to their head, and you can imagine maybe today that that smartphone does interfere with the cigarette, but as electronic cigarettes become more complex, there could be interference and inappropriate performance. So IE 60601-1 is over 300 pages long, but I'd like to provide an example of a standard that might be relevant to the products that we're discussing today. So this showed that over time, that the temperature of the parts of the device that are in contact with the user or patient maintains a certain level. So you wouldn't want the electronic cigarette getting overly hot while it's being used, just like your smartphone gets warm when you're using it. As you can imagine, there are standards for all kinds of consumer products, including mobile phones, laptops, and children's toys. Coincidentally, the Consumer Product Safety Commission sent out a notice to consumers just one day before the FDA workshop on battery-powered medical devices, reminding users about shopping safely when purchasing batteries and chargers for use with their smartphones. That notice also reminded everyone that there are standards to improve the safety and performance of these devices. So how is this discussion about standards relevant to e-cigarettes? Well, here's a recent story. We've seen many similar stories in this. My colleagues and friends from across the nation are always sending me stories about exploding batteries. And I think it's easy to agree that we don't want to have things happen. Coincidentally, I think the rest of this article, if you actually read this one from the CBS News, has a statement that from a manufacturer that says they've never heard of this problem before. So I think it's hard to believe now with all these events. So what are some concerns? So these concerns shouldn't be a surprise for anyone here today. In fact, I found a list of concerns online, and one of the speakers mentioned clone devices. So there's a lot of copycat devices, and of course, if you're copycatting the battery of the device itself, those are just as subject to failure. And as I conclude my presentation, I suggest that you consider this question: how would standards improve the safety and performance of e-cigarettes? Thanks for attending today's workshop and for the Center for Tobacco Products for having me speak. Thank you.
Okay, now for Sud Patwardhan from Nickel Ventures, British American Tobacco Group, speaking on e-cigarette regulation in the European Union, progress made on product quality and safety standards.
And I already showed you that.
Hello all, I'm Sud, or Sudhanshu Patwardhan for short. I work at Nico Ventures, which is part of British American Tobacco Group, and I trained as a medical doctor back in India. Have worked in the BAT group for the last 9 years in the tobacco harm reduction program of the company, and for the last 2 years in Nico Ventures, which is part of BAT, specifically looking at regulation, the regulatory landscape, and specifically focused on electronic cigarettes. I want to thank the FDA CTP for the opportunity for us to bring the European perspective in terms of regulation, how things are changing there, what's law, and also activities in the standards space that are happening at a very rapid pace in the EU. So on that note, just give a bit of, an outline of what I'm going to talk about, just a brief introduction about Nico Ventures, tobacco product directive and what it means and where it is at the moment, and the standards activities. If there's a lot of acronyms in this presentation, and so if you find it a bit too overwhelming or if you doze off, what I would like you to remember or take away from this presentation is this, that the TPD, or the Tobacco Product Directive, is law now. It came into force earlier this year in the EU, in the European Union, and it's got a time frame of over the next 2 to 3 years for it to be rolled out and implemented in the member states of the European Union. So that's one thing to bear in mind. And the second message to take home from this, I would like, is that standards initiatives in the UK and France particularly on product quality and product safety are well underway and in a very constructive, positive, multi-stakeholder sort of process that's allowing it to really take in a lot of views from different sectors, different stakeholders, and hoping to really raise quality and safety standards to assure consumers and regulators alike. So that's the message. Now back to the presentation, obviously. Nicoventis is part of the BAT Group. As I said earlier, it's separate from the tobacco business. Our focus is the development and production of innovative, high-quality inhaled nicotine products that meet relevant regulatory requirements. Our aim is to provide adult smokers, the emphasis is very clear, adult smokers and users of nicotine products who want to reduce or completely replace their smoking habit with less risky alternatives and which are acceptable to them as alternatives. And that's what Nicoventis stands for. We have products in the UK market, electronic cigarette products. Now, on to TPD. The Tobacco Product Directive, it lays down the rules governing the manufacture, the presentation, the sale of tobacco and related products in the European Union. So it's sort of an umbrella regulatory framework for all European member states in the European Union, obviously. That's 28 of those member states, example being the UK, France, Germany, Portugal, Spain, so on and so forth. So the TPD is that overarching framework, and that includes, so since it was revised this year, it now also includes electronic cigarettes, but of course it covers tobacco products such as cigarettes, roll your own tobacco, smokeless tobacco, herbal products for smoking, and so on. The new TPD, which is TPD2, some people call it, came into force earlier this year in May, and the member states are obliged to transpose that, so put into their local national regulations in the next two years, with another 6 months to a year for actual implementation and enforcement. So that's the timeline. The TPD is comprised of 33 articles, of which the article of interest for us in this audience for today's presentation is Article 20, which focuses on electronic cigarettes. So what does the TPD do for electronic cigarettes? What it does, given the way it is designed, is it provides two options for member states and for manufacturers in member states. The TPD option for e-cigarettes is where, as long as the products, the e-cigarettes, are within limit in terms of the nicotine content, in this case 20 milligrams per mil, or the volume of the refill containers, not more than 10 mils, or the volume of the tank or the cartridge, not to exceed 2 mils, it can fall under the TPD part of e-cigarettes, or e-cigarettes can be part of TPD in that sense. Of course, with that come restrictions on what can and cannot be said, and of course you can't make therapeutic claims. There'll be health warnings mandated by the TPD itself and also by the state, member state. There'll be requirements for child-proofing and so on and so forth. There'll be requirements for a pre-market notification as well, which is now being defined as we speak. The other option, of course, is for the manufacturer to go the medicines route. So a manufacturer could put a product to the medicines agency of that country and say, listen, we would like to have a marketing authorization for this product for smoking cessation. And that would give them a certain different range of freedoms in terms of distribution depending on which country you are in, of course. So for example, in the UK, you would be able to sell an NRT product for cessation not only on prescription or over the counter, but also in general sales in a convenience store, for example. That may not be true for other European markets, mind you. But the range of freedoms, the ability to make therapeutic claims will exist with that route. So what happens in the TPD next? As I mentioned earlier, that it is law as published in the official journal of the European Union in May earlier this year. Now, in the next 2 years, the Commission, which is the European Commission sitting in Brussels, will be defining elements of what needs to go or the template that's required for submitting data for pre-market notification by manufacturers. The bottom line of all that, the left-hand side of this slide, is essentially the Commission's working on it now. It's in a consultation mode. It's developing that template, and it'll be out in the next year or so. At the same time, the member states, the UK, the Germany, the France, are also working on how to define certain specific bits of the TPD that they are required to do in terms of transposition or translating the TPD into actual implementing actual law for the national regulations. And that includes specific content on health warnings, advertising or advertising restrictions in some cases, and some more nitty-gritty on the cross-border sales and elements of the TPD that are not yet completely defined. So this is all happening. Now, this is where I'm going to transition into what does that mean for consumers, for the regulatory landscape going forward, and for public health, and for the industry, of course. So I'm just going to take a pause here, because what it means is products, e-cigarettes in the European Union, most markets can continue to be there till 2016, or a bit later than that, the way they are at the moment. All the requirements mentioned on the left-hand column under Article 20 will not really come into force in most markets for a while to come. Now, let's keep that thought, hold that thought. The other thing is, you might see data coming from the UK, for example, which excites a lot of public health advocates, those who believe in tobacco harm reduction, looking at 2 million smokers who have either completely or partially switched out of smoking thanks to e-cigarettes. And indeed, it is a massive public health story there. But the missed opportunity there and the potential positive opportunity there is that the remaining 8 million smokers in the UK are either ones who have not tried e-cigarettes at all or are a bit hesitant to try electronic cigarettes given the news in the media or their personal experience in terms of quality and safety of products. So there is a need here, and there's this sort of regulatory vacuum, if I can use that phrase, for the next 2 years, where if the industry takes leadership and takes along regulators and other key stakeholders with them in the UK and elsewhere in the EU, they have an opportunity to voluntarily raise product quality and safety standards, and hopefully we'll have a net positive public health impact. So what's happening in that space then? I'll talk about BSI, the British Standards Institution, and also touch upon AFNOR, which is in France, the French National Standards Body, and the European level standards body, which is CEN. So the BSI commissioned, so BSI is the UK standards body, national standards body, and is involved, as perhaps some of you are who are familiar with BSI, involved in all sorts of standards across all sorts of industries, including heavy engineering, hardware, software, and services, and so on and so forth. For them, they saw the opportunity and the need for a standard in the electronic cigarette space. They approached the e-cigarette trade association in the UK, ECETA, earlier this year to say, can we put something together as a industry-sponsored standard, which would be called as a industry best practice, but effectively is going to be a publicly available specification that companies can voluntarily choose to sign up to, and that allows them to say that, yes, we are complying with this. Usually the pathway for such voluntary standards is they can then migrate up to become a national standard and subsequently a European regional standard, potentially an international standard. So this is, as far as I know and as far as I've seen out there so far, the first initiative from a national standards organization to actually go out and say, listen, can we do something about it? There's such a dire need for doing this. And of course, as you see in the slides, the idea is that this is for manufacturers and for other suppliers in the supply chain and for laboratories who will be testing these products to these standards. So this was initiated. They put a steering group together, which I believe the intent was to have it as representative as possible, including small, medium, large companies in the e-cigarette business. We were very fortunate as Nico Ventures to be invited to be part of that. And we had talked about product standards for the last year and a half. We had put our views out in public conferences, and that was part of the reason we were invited there to that. And we also have public health thought leaders in that steering group and as well consumer advocates, actual consumers of e-cigarettes who are part of the steering group. We also have a trading standards representative. So it is, I believe, a multi-stakeholder sort of process, but then that's to be expected because that's how BSI does its standards. Anyways, now, just a little qualifier here, that what I'm putting up here is what is in the draft publicly available specification, or PASS, that was published earlier in November, which went out for public consultation for 4 weeks, and it elicited an overwhelming response from a wide range of stakeholders, and I believe this was perhaps the largest response BSI ever got on anything in terms of at least nearly 1,000 responses from across different stakeholder groups. And rightly so. I mean, we are all here and we understand that there's a lot of different views. And the approach that that we have taken with the draft PASS, which was published and which elicited that response, was to put the elements of product quality standards and safety standards out there in a structured format, perhaps to some people's concern, too much detail for others, maybe not enough there, and of course there's that view that any consultation will elicit. So this is just what we have tried to capture in the draft. Of course, after the consultation, after the responses, we have the next few months to actually go through all those hundreds of responses and try and incorporate some of the very constructive comments into the revised draft. And we still believe that we'll be aiming for publishing it in the first half of 2015. And just to sort of touch upon for yesterday's presentations, earlier today, some of the presentations from other companies in the e-cigarette space, everyone's talking about the need for product standards. The scientists who are working in the space asking for product standards, and it's like a no-brainer, really. But then the question is, what do you mean by that? What do you put in there? How high do you raise the bar? And what you've tried there is trying to sort of capture some of the key issues that e-cigarettes as a category face in the minds of public health, regulators, and consumers. And we just heard about batteries as a challenge. Now, there are existing directives in the EU where you could easily connect your BSI pass or the draft standard and the published standard subsequently saying, can we recommend that directive be followed, because that takes care of most of the issues of battery charging and recharging, as an example. The more contentious ones are, of course, the ones in the field of toxicological risk assessment and how far you go in terms of emissions testing. Are there enough testing validated methods out there that can be immediately applied for e-cigarette aerosol that can be then transferred into making sense of the data and so on and so forth? So there are a lot of things that need to be resolved, but that shouldn't stop us from putting the first draft out there for consultation, which we did, and then the first final product for informing future industry behavior. And if companies start voluntarily complying with this, I think what it achieves is a certain level of confidence in consumers and other stakeholders in the community on what this means and whether they can actually trust the category. Because the public health win, the gain, is far more than what the concerns are raised about. So if you can address some of the easily addressable concerns, battery charging being one, the quality of ingredients used in the e-liquids, for example, being the other, these are easy wins that can hopefully make the category sustainable long-term and also build that confidence, as I keep on talking about. So that's that. A reference to what Scott said earlier in terms of standards wars. Thankfully, I hope we don't have any standards wars yet. The BSI process is in parallel to the AFNOR process in France, which has a similar sort of similar multi-stakeholder group working on a similar plan. And the good news is that we are talking to them, and between us, we'll be publishing on a sort of similar timeline. And we then also have approached the CEN, which is the European-wide standards body, which also is indicated to be the body that the European Commission is going to go for actually putting some meat around the existing TPD proposals. So it looks like it's all sort of in the right direction, and the attempts by some of the industry players to kind of bring together these different ideas and different simple things that can be done to raise the quality and safety standards of products is hopefully gaining traction. Now, I'm going to leave you with this slide, but the point I'm making is, as I said in the message earlier, that TPD is here, and it's going to be rolled out in terms of implementing and fleshing it out in the next 2.5-3 years. Standards raised by industry in consort with the rest of the key stakeholders in the public health and scientific and regulatory community will hopefully make the category more sustainable, and we are happy to share these learnings with beyond Europe, and hence we are here. So thanks for your patience, and any questions we'll answer in the panel. Thanks.
Thank you, and if the panelists can come up to the table, please. And then I have a question. Is Dr. Quinlan here? Dr. Quinlan, for the next panel, we are thinking of doing a little bit of rearranging. I'm not seeing her. Okay, that will alter our ability to do that. And again, as I'm seeing cards go to the side, that's great. Write your questions on the card and send them to the side, and we'll have the questions come up. And we'll here's what I'm thinking as we're getting this panel going. Because we have some extra time, I thought of moving the panel up from right after lunch to right before lunch. But we need the speaker here, Dr. Quinlan. So if she comes in while we're doing this question, this panel, then we might do that. So we'll stay flexible. Let me move to... Right. Dr. Lauterbach, this one is for you. What standards are needed for e-cigarettes to assume maximum benefit and minimum risk? That might be a whole panel question, actually. So, but it does say for Dr. Lauterbach, but I think that we'll start out with that very simple, short question. What standards are needed for e-cigarettes to assure maximum benefit and minimum risk?
Well, part of the process on developing consensus standards is bringing in all concerned parties. I mean, until you bring in producers, users, general interest regulators, you don't have a complete view of what each of the participating parties would like to see in that standard. So this is basically part of the thing of consensus standards is is bring in all the concerned parties. And that may modify the result. But I mean, one person would actually have to start off in saying, well, this is putting it out as a draft standard, and this thing where it goes.
Let's have everyone go for that one. If you can turn your microphone off, please, Dr. Lauterbach. Thanks.
So I would agree. I think it's very important, and you know we did just see some examples of where the European Union and the UK are through BSI, AFNOR, and then this seems like CEN is involved in overseeing. But, you know, I guess if we wanted to be a little selfish, we'd be like, well, what about us, you know, approach as well? So what is the approach in those standards? How well, how much of an understanding do we have there to get the full balance and understanding then what additional value we could have? So I would expect probably that through CEN that those standards might be proposed into an ISO or IEC standard as appropriate as a, you know, already published European standard, but... if there wasn't appropriate, if all the other stakeholders of ISO didn't have an opportunity to help develop that content, I'm kind of thinking of that slide that I had mm-hmm. earlier. You're mm-hmm. stepping in at a much later stage, so the ability to modify that content to ensure the standard has what is absolutely necessary to address the concerns that I think have been raised here, even just in a short period today, might get missed in a lot of areas.
Yes. I can just add to the existing published draft PAS that we have from BSI, and the learning from the consultation, if I can say like that, is that of the few hundred responses, many are asking for it to be less demanding, and then there, of course, those from the from pharmaceutical backgrounds, companies, and of course regulators saying, hang on, can you actually sort of crank it up a bit? So the challenge there is to, and maybe that's the question that's being asked, there are some very important ones to address straight away, and I mentioned batteries earlier, and that's a very clear one where compliance is absolutely important to not only assure consumer safety, but also take care of some of the news, the media sort of that goes around it. Another one is just contaminants, and that can be easily addressed, I believe, not at a significant cost either in terms of the quality of the base ingredients used in the product, and we've heard about this yesterday in the entire day as well a few times, that the nicotine, the propylene glycol, the glycerol have to be sourced and to be either European or US farm grade. So these are easy wins, and I keep on using the phrase, but the real point is easy wins for not only the industries at significantly lower cost than anything else that would be demanded from a regulation, but also from a public health point of view. So that's the opportunity to have the right balance struck there, I think.
Yeah, one of the things that we found when we were talking about standards for battery-powered medical devices and engaging a lot of outside stakeholders, both during the workshop and afterwards, is that they wanted to make sure that we didn't put all the devices sort of into one category and to allow flexibility for the types of devices out there, which is tremendously important given the risk levels and how these devices are used. And there's a lot of interest in having a lot of flexibility, not only thinking about what's available on the market today, but about the products that are currently in the pipeline and what's in the future. Because I think it's important when you might recognize a standard that it doesn't limit or basically take out a technology that might be safer or more appropriate in the future with what we know today about the products.
Is the FDA Modernization Act, can it accommodate electronic cigarettes? The FDA Modernization Act, can it accommodate e-cigarettes?
You know, I actually probably couldn't answer that. I'd have to look to my colleagues for Center Tobacco. I think there's a lot of discussion going on about how current regulations and acts can apply as appropriate. I don't think anyone's interested in trying to reinvent the wheel over. If we're referring to the part of the act that discusses the center's ability to recognize a standard to satisfy any part of the act that associates itself to medical devices, I think those are tools that the agency is aware of and familiar with, and I think it really kind of depends on what's the construct of the regulatory structure into which the Center for Tobacco is going to be addressing these products. I'm not the qualified person, obviously, to answer that question, but I think there's that, my understanding of working with the Center for Tobacco is that it's information gathering, and they're trying to do what they feel is best and to appropriately regulate the product to meet the needs of what the public concerns are and the safety factors.
Okay, so saying that, this next one. This one is for you, Scott. When recognizing a standard, how do you ensure that you don't create a situation where the fox is guarding the hen house?
The fox is guarding the hen house. So in order, we have a process internally in our center a set of groups that govern the different areas of science that we fall into. So whether it's a vertical area like orthopedic products, cardiovascular, or very process-oriented, or a horizontal scientific area like biocompatibility or materials, nanotechnology. We have an internal group of experts that represent what I consider the total product life cycle of a product. So someone from the pre-market, the post-market, the enforcement, our biosurveillance, our laboratories, represent their office's point of views on a particular subject. So when a standard is proposed from the public or comes online from a new publication, we look at that. We look to see if we were involved. If we were, who was the expert? Could they come in and have a dialogue with us about how the standard was developed? Were there some agendas on the table during that standards development process that we should be aware of? How does that standard satisfy the need? And so there's an entire process that goes through, real similar to how a standard is developed, to ensure there's balance, that we have a process in order to hear people's comments and concerns. And if we feel it is appropriate, we will recognize that standard as appropriate. And so the three standards that Ken had identified in the battery area, that's exactly what we did, is we had that dialogue internally, and we felt that those standards would be the best suited for us.
Okay.
Does that kind of answer?
Okay. Dr. Patwardhan, can one particular brand of e-cig be both Article 20 TBD, Article 20, do you know what Article 20 is? Okay. And medically regulated. Can they both be marketed with the same name? So let's start out with the first part of the question, because I think those are kind of different. Can one particular brand of e-cigarette be both Article 20 and medically regulated?
That's a trick question for sure. I have to say that I can't answer it. I don't know the legal aspects of how it would sort of play out in the marketplace, to be honest. It seems unlikely you can do both, that's for sure. But this is, again, how it's been the law has been made now. The way it's going to be interpreted is over the next 2 years, it's going to be transposition, and that's where it will be very evident how it can be used and not used. So I don't know the answer to that. It's a frank one. Sorry.
All right. Anyone else want to try that one?
Well, I know with respect to medical devices, there are sometimes devices that are regulated as medical products by FDA and also regulated by other agencies, such as the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Take something for simple as a helmet. If a helmet is used in a patient with epilepsy as a way to prevent them from injuring themselves when they fall, then it's regulated by FDA. But that same helmet, when used in high school sports in a non-professional way, is regulated by Consumer Product Safety Commission. And that exact same helmet is regulated by OSHA when used in the NFL, which is a business and a professional organization. So it's the exact same product. Things like wheelchairs, powered wheelchairs, these scooters that you see, whether they're from home use or for other uses. I remember seeing a wheelchair that was intended to be used, going out into the water. It just seems like a crazy idea if you can't walk to go into deep water. But these different types of products are used on the individual patients and what their needs are.
This question, Sue, is for you, because, and I'm thinking maybe Dr. Lauterbach, you might want to, in your opinion, do you feel the threshold of 20 milligrams per ml is too low? And is there a risk here of e-cig users reverting back to smoking?
Do you want
to? A lot of concerns have been raised about that ceiling that was introduced in the TPD with claims that it is quite arbitrary without any scientific evidence base. Now, if you ask me my view as a company, I would say, listen, this is what the law is, and we have to abide by that. We believe that we can get products which would be meeting that requirement and still be consumer acceptable going forward. But that means that innovation really has to be cranked up in get the right products, but there's a clear risk there for sure.
Dr. Lauterbach, did you want to go there?
Well, I think basically here we need to know more about the use. I know when I personally make up e-liquids for my own use, I use more than the 2%. I mean, I go higher than that, and I think there's a good reason for it, just in terms of satisfaction. That's just my personal opinion on it.
Okay. Well, and it did say for your, you know, opinion, so okay. Dr. Padwardhan, you showed a child-proof cap, and I'm going to change that to child-resistant cap, since from yesterday we learned there's no child-proof. So we'll say a child-resistant cap drawing. Is there a standard for 2015 or a suggested cap as a standard? I'm not remembering, but I may have missed that slide. So you showed a child-resistant cap drawing. Is that a standard for 2015? Okay, so let's just go. In the European Tobacco Product Directive, was there a standard for child-resistant packaging? What does it look like?
It would be child-proof, but the right phrase is child-resistant for sure.
I saw that on your slide, too, and I wondered. So they're going for child-proof.
Yeah, but that's the expectation should not. It has to be child-resistant, because in the past when we proposed product standards in the absence of the TPD, the idea was to have child-resistant. Proofing doesn't just practically not work, really. So it has to be child-resistant for sure.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. Okay, so if 2 million two million people who smoke switch completely or partially to e-cigarettes, what is the proportion of complete switchers versus partial switchers, known as dual use? Again, Sue, I think this was in your presentation, that 2 million people who smoke in the UK, in the EU, switch completely or partially to e-cigarettes. So did they switch completely, or did they become also dual users?
I need to look at the exact data, to be honest, so I can't just rattle off exact percentages, but the fairly large number of people who have actually completely switched out of smoking using electronic cigarettes, I believe it's about the 2 million we're talking about.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Here's a series of is what you'd called it. Okay. Beyond UL, ETL, CE, FCC, and CSA, battery and testing, device testing, and their standards. What else do e-vapor products need?
A bunch of acronyms, and then what's the question?
Right. And their standards, besides all of those standards, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, battery and device testing and their standards, what else do e-vapor products need? And I'm thinking that if we don't know what those initials, or if those aren't familiar with all of you, then, but maybe the question is, do you need more than 5 standards?
Well, I do know. I mean, in terms of what FDA does, there are standards and there are also guidance documents that outline FDA's currently thinking on certain things.
Uh-huh.
They aren't always necessarily binding, but they do provide some insights into FDA's expectations and the regulation of products. And I think setting those guidelines out help people understand what to do and how to make better products and how to test them in all kinds of different ways.
Okay.
Often you'll see some e-liquid or e-cigarette packages with all this alphabet soup of initials, but there's been no certification there about the quality of the ingredients used and whether they're stable or not.
Okay.
So the ROHS and these other things generally applies to the electronic side, and nothing said about the e-liquid side or materials in contact with the e-liquid.
Good point.
So I'm going to add on to the alphabet soup, and what I heard from, you know, we heard UL, and you know, you could consider UL a standard developing organization or a conformity assessment a certifier for, if you look on mm-hmm. the back end of some of these products, you see CE on there. On the back of that television, I guarantee you'll see both CE, UL, ULC, mm-hmm. and a number of other alphabet soups, mm-hmm. and those are conformity assessment, third-party conformity assessment pressed by, in many cases, some sort of regulatory compliance need, a law, a European need to get onto the market. You go through this to get a CE mark in Europe. And so a lot of times laboratories such as UL or TUV and such are accredited through the laboratory accreditation procedures to take on standards that would satisfy a requirement in order to make through and to get to the market. So there's different types of conformance. There's a basic level of conformance through a signed declaration towards a standard. That's something that our center does in Center for Devices. You can have more mark. That's something that OSHA does through its NERDL program. So someone who needs to have a certification for worker safety, such as the NFL's helmets, I'm assuming, would have to go through because they are workers and they are protected under OSHA's laws, has to have some sort of certification. Our own products, sometimes if you talk about, you know, we hear standards wars, well, there's regulatory overlap in regulatory where you come into the FDA and get your clearance for, say, an infusion pump, but you need to get cleared also for worker safety if that's going to be plugged into a hospital because the worker needs to be protected from electrical safety. Thankfully, we're working together as a department as much as we can with the different departments to ensure we're using the same mm-hmm. standards and to help that out. So it kind of, the favorite answer of it depends, but it really goes into the different levels. So here I think they were kind of asking about conformity assessment practices that can be employed from known standards or future standards that would be developed to see, is that a tool that would help assess, you know, regulatory compliance or else like. So.
Okay. Yes. Okay. I'm sorry to say. Okay. For a novel product like electronic cigarettes, what is a realistic timeline for developing new standards? Anyone go for that one, yeah.
So standard developing organizations have timelines that they try to abide by. ISO recently updated its directives, the ISO and IEC updated its directives, part two or part one, I forget, that allows standards to come in and follow even a quicker pathway. So you could go in the ISO world in as little as 2 years from new work item proposal to publication. It really depends on, you know, I hate using that word, but it depends on what's the stage of the standard when it's introduced. If you're starting off with just a scope and an idea and you have to fill it all in, you have a lot more work ahead of you. But if you come in based upon a lot of sound research, or let's say VSI submits its standard forward to ISO, you have a construct to work from, and so you might be able to move that. Each organization, even in the U.S., ASTM has a different balloting process than AMI, than IEEE. So it falls into what's the most appropriate standard organization to do the types of things you're trying to do. Are you developing a test method for a particular test versus much more encompassing and would probably be volumes thicker than maybe just a specific test method for a toxicological method, you know, to assess something specific to e-cigarettes. So.
Before, let me, because you may want to address this too. So we heard yesterday in this morning in the public comment session that these products are changing so incredibly rapidly that, you know, what we heard about yesterday is 8 years old, or, you know, it's old, right? So what's the consumers are using today is different, you know, and it's different broadly across a rapidly changing product. So in that instance, does that impact what you're making the standards for if the product is...
I can try to hit that. So a couple decades ago, it was very common to see very specific quantitative standards with endpoints, and even more so, you would find design standards, which is not the case today. Today, you see standards that are a little bit more process-driven, tape processes and allowances for such things as design, you know, criteria, risk management processes, evaluation from human factors and other testing principles to create that standard, which allows to establish the framework for the safety issues that we know aren't new. Those are the same issues that were there 8 years ago as they are today. And it allows people to, through other methods, describe how they're still meeting those basic safety criteria and justifying those endpoints that aren't necessarily in the standard, but has the framework of what you need to do to get there and have that, I don't know if this is even a word, the quantification of your results to be understood and why now you still are meeting that, what is today's level of knowledge from the technological advancements, the understanding of maybe new safety issues. So the standards can be developed in such a way, and they have evolved over the last few decades to try to meet that
okay,
need.
Dr. Lauterbach?
One of the issues on test method development is, number one, once you decide you're going to do the test method and has some, you know, example methods you might want to evaluate, is the time getting out a set of test materials out to the participating laboratories, allowing them time to run these, and then getting the results back and having evaluation of the results. And oftentimes the time that people might need to volunteer, the laboratories need to volunteer to get this testing done, can be considerable and can be a considerable overhead for their operations, particularly for the private laboratories as opposed to laboratories in a large company. So that can be a considerable time delay even in when you're trying to get out a standard as rapidly as possible.
Okay. Any other? Scott?
And one of the things to consider, too, is recognizing existing standards or parts of standards, which can be much, much quicker. Certainly, there are a lot of standards for communication between electronic devices that might apply to a smartphone but also could apply to an e-cigarette or for a battery. There's lots of bits and pieces in consumer products, and there are already standards there that can be recognized to get us a head start.
All right. Dr. Lauterbach, you mentioned that there's ample data on ventilation toxicology of flavoring ingredients.
Yes.
I have seen data that 27 food ingredient flavors need further testing for ventilation. Can you expand on what data is available and whether or not the combination of flavorings under heat are likely to cause new harm risks that are not already comprehended in the data available?
Well, first, I think we're talking about inhalation toxicology. And I mean, one of the things we, in conjunction with the development of cigarette flavorings versus that, those that may be satisfactory for e-cigarettes, and there are things that I would allow as a regulator or as a company toxicologist, I would allow in a cigarette flavor that I would not want in an e-cigarette flavor. For example, reaction wouldn't want anything in an e-cigarette flavor that would essentially be non-volatile or giving me undefined pyrolysis products. So I think that needs further clarification about what particular concerns they're asking.
Okay. Right. Handwriting. I was thinking it's gold standard, but could standardization alleviate the need to make extensive data submissions within product approval applications, and what are the limitations? So could standardizations alleviate the need to make extensive data submissions within product approval applications? What are those limits?
So I'll speak to it, you know, as it relates to our processes in Center for Devices, where we have
you know, the most common product that we see, submission that we see is a 510K for your typical class 2 class, you know, devices, which is lower than the class 3 where you'd submit a pre-market application. But through that, the process that our recognition of a standard does is to help, you know, and it's actually written into the law, is that in lieu of providing all the background data, if we recognize a standard, what we're communicating is we understand that test method, we understand the process, we may, and if it's a full standard, a complete standard, we even agree to the endpoints that that standard has built into it. And so depending upon the type of standard that it is, if it is a full, like say, ASTM test method with endpoints, conformity may satisfy that part of the regulatory question that we would ask versus having to see the full. If it's a standard on risk management, you know, ISO 14971, if you said I declare conformance, okay, let's see your risk assessment. What did you use? An FMEA, another model, but it doesn't stop there. I think the same thing goes for electrical safety. You don't declare conformance to electrical safety in the current edition because the current edition employs a risk management process into it, mm-hmm. where the industry navigates how they chose which parts of that massive 343-page standard applies to their specific product. But that dialogue doesn't stop with just saying we comply, but it really does shrink down that, you know, what could be volumes of information down into a summary test report, possibly, or a summary test report with maybe some additional annexes to describe maybe a deviation they had to employ into the standard because of new technology that was employed into their device. And so that's the flexibility that the Center for Devices has, is that you can use the standard, you can use the standard as published. You can even have the communication with us, and if you had to deviate from that standard because of new technological advancements, but that standard still applies best to your product, but we needed to have that justification discussion on how we amended that or altered that standard. So it still works as a great tool to shorten all the back and forth that goes across if you didn't have that resource.
Thank you.
And I think I can give one example for battery-powered devices, and there's a requirement for the temperature not to exceed 41 degrees for an implantable device, and that's in the standard, and that's the one I actually showed on the screen. But in fact, the testing methods to do that are not described in the standard with sufficient detail to know whether or not the manufacturer is going to get the result that you expect. They could have put the pulse generator in a different medium where the conductivity is different. They could have shorted the battery for a short period of time. The battery could have been partially depleted. There's all kinds of things that, while well-intentioned, can go wrong in your testing such that you think you're fulfilling the requirements of the standard, but in fact, in other worst cases, you would not.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? That's it for the questions coming through? All right, and I have a yellow light, meaning that we're near the end. So thank you very much for the speakers and panelists. Thank you very much. Let me just ask one more time if a doctor has arrived. Well, then we're going to have an earlier lunch. So the kiosk is aware? Yeah. I'm sorry? Oh, she'll go check. And the other opportunity is that Dr. Hotchkiss, maybe we split it up a bit. Because we do want that kiosk ready. I saw how long the line was yesterday, so. I'm sorry? So we can wait a few minutes? Well, I'm wondering if we have Dr. Hotchkiss go next. Okay. All right, it's a tandem presentation. So, slowly go out in the line. And so we'll have more time for lunch, too. So it is, right now I have 11:20. Let's come back at 12:30. I don't think anybody will mind finishing early today. Is that a problem? So let's come back at 12:30, okay? 12:30. Thank you. Again, don't leave your goods here. We will not be watching them, protecting them for you. So please take them with you. Thank you very much.